Imagine a musician, right? Like a musician deciding to cover a universally beloved pop song. You know the exact type I'm talking about.
Oh, absolutely. The kind of upbeat, lightweight melody that's just permanently lodged in our collective unconscious.
Yeah, exactly. The one that makes you tap your foot without even realizing you're doing it.
Right, because it feels inherently safe.
Yeah.
You already know every single beat and lyric by heart, so you just relax into it.
Chafing familiar, totally.
Yeah.
But then this musician gets into the studio and they just completely flip the architecture of the piece.
Like turning it inside out.
Right. They drastically slow the tempo way down. They transpose all those bright major chords into minor keys, and they strip away every single piece of cheerful, bouncy instrumentation.
And suddenly, those exact same lyrics that used to make you want to dance on a Friday night, they feel devastating.
Yes, the original message just fractures. It reveals something incredibly dark and profound that was actually hiding there the entire time, just buried under a glossy commercial beat.
Because it becomes a method to bypass our usual psychological filters, you know?
Oh, that's a great way to put it. Bypass the filters.
Yeah, we assume we know what we're listening to, so we leave our emotional doors wide open. And then, well, the trap springs.
The trap springs. And welcome to today's deep dive, because our mission today is to explore that exact same phenomenon, but in the visual arts.
Right. We're going to extract the hidden structural critique embedded within a single powerful piece of contemporary art.
We are looking at a watercolor painting titled El Chico by the Colombian artist Wairo Duque.
Which it serves as a central anchor for a much larger exhibition he put together called Trastio.
Yeah, and to really get into the DNA of this piece, the sources we have on the table for you today are the artwork itself, alongside the artist's highly detailed technical and studio notes.
Which are fascinating, by the way. They really give you a window into the process.
They really do. We're going to see how taking a universally recognized comedic image and completely recodifying it can force you to confront the raw, crude realities of social displacement and precariousness in modern Latin America.
Because the artist's notes make it very clear that this is not a nostalgic tribute.
Right.
The painting functions as a diagnostic lens to examine deep structural problems using a visual code that we instinctively trust.
Okay, let's unpack this, because to really understand that structural critique, we actually need to start at the microscopic level.
Literally microscopic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Before we even look at the visual subject of the painting, we have to look at the physical materials Duke chose to use. The medium really is the message here.
It is. The technical notes for El Chico are remarkably specific about those materials.
Like down to the brand, right?
Exactly. They detail a 15 by 22 inch watercolor painted exclusively with Daniel Smith brand pigments.
Okay.
But the most crucial detail is the support structure itself. It is painted on 640 gram, cold pressed, rough grain Arches paper.
So if you have ever dabbled in painting or, held standard watercolor paper, you know it's usually around 300 grams.
Right, which is fairly sturdy.
Yeah, it has some flex to it. But 640 grams, that is more than double the weight.
It's massive.
It is essentially as rigid and thick as heavy cardboard. So why would an artist require that level of structural integrity just to paint a watercolor?
Well, you have to consider the physical nature of watercolor as a medium. It is inherently destructive to paper.
Oh, because of the water.
Exactly. Water warps, it buckles, and it weakens thin surfaces over time. By selecting a 640 gram paper, the artist is essentially giving himself permission to be physically violent with the material.
So he is creating a surface that can take an absolute beating without tearing.
You hit the nail on the head. He is aggressively scraping, scratching, removing pigment by brute force, and literally drowning the paper in heavy layers of water.
Wow.
Yeah, and the psychological impact of this process cannot be overstated. The physical weight of the paper resisting this extreme punishment directly mirrors the emotional intensity of the subject matter.
Wait, that's incredible. So it simulates the psychological impact of surviving severe social wear and tear?
Precisely. The paper itself is forced to endure a hostile environment just to exist as an artwork.
So the paper is surviving the painting process the exact same way the subjects are surviving their reality.
Exactly.
That is a brilliant physical metaphor. And I think that perfectly explains the other technical choice the Daniel Smith paints on that rough grain paper.
Yes, the chemistry here is just as important as the physical weight.
Let's delve into how those pigments actually behave, because it's not just standard paint, is it?
No, not at all. The key chemical reaction here is the granulation process.
Okay, let's break down how that mechanism works for everyone listening.
Sure. So these specific watercolors are manufactured using real heavy mineral pigments.
Right. And because that 640-gram paper is rough grain, if you were to look at it under a microscope, the surface isn't flat.
Not even close to flat.
It is full of deep, cavernous crevices and high, jagged peaks.
And when the artist floods the paper with water, those heavy mineral particles literally drop and settle deep into the microscopic valleys of the paper.
While the lighter pigments just kind of float and dry on the top, right?
Exactly. And the visual result of that chemistry is extraordinary. The paint refuses to dry into a flat, smooth, pleasing wash of color.
Because it's catching in all those little valleys.
Right. Instead, it creates a rugged, fractured texture that perfectly mirrors urban decay.
Oh, wow.
The paint is physically simulating the grime, the peeling layers, and the corrosive deterioration of an old city wall.
So the material is doing the emotional heavy lifting before your eye even registers the figures in the painting.
The texture tells the story of abandonment before the subjects do.
That is wild. But reading through these sources, I keep hitting this fascinating contradiction.
Which one?
Well, the physical process of making this art is aggressive and violent, right? The paper is taking a beating. The texture is corroding.
Right, right.
And the subject matter is inspired by the harsh realities of Colombian streets. Yet, the artist's studio notes describe his own emotional approach while painting it as deeply sober and contained.
Yeah, it seems counterintuitive.
Completely. How do you violently scrape paper to depict structural poverty while remaining emotionally sober?
Well, the notes actually point us toward the geography of creation.
Okay, what does that mean?
So El Chico was painted in July 2025, but it wasn't painted on a bustling street corner in Colombia.
Right.
It was painted in a quiet, isolated studio in Whittier, California, utilizing web references.
Wait, really?
Yes. He was thousands of miles away from the barrios and the communities that actually inspired the piece.
Okay, wait, I have to challenge that approach for a second.
Sure, go ahead.
If you are creating a piece about the raw, crude reality of displaced communities in Latin America, doesn't sitting in a quiet, comfortable studio in California make the art inherently less authentic?
I see where you're going with this.
Like, why not paint it on the streets that actually inspired it? It feels like distance might water down the impact, you know?
That is a completely natural assumption. But the geographic displacement actually functions as a decanting filter.
A decanting filter.
Think about the psychology of creation. If an artist is sitting on the street, surrounded by the immediate, loud urgency of poverty and visible trauma, their creative reaction is almost always volcanic.
Ah, I see. They are angry, overwhelmed, and absorbing that anxiety in real time.
Exactly. Indignation just takes over the brush. You might end up painting something that feels more like an angry, reactionary political pamphlet than a nuanced structural critique.
Oh, that makes total sense. So the silence and the physical distance of that studio in California offer a crucial psychological buffer.
It does. It allows the artist to process the visual memory of those displaced communities with calculated control.
Right. He can observe the trauma with maturity, deciding exactly how much tension to apply rather than being swept away by immediate rage.
Exactly. The distance is the only thing that allows that sober and contained execution.
Okay, I get it now. So if he is working with all this calculated restraint in a California studio, how does that actually translate to the canvas?
Well, because he isn't yelling at the viewer. He's being deliberately quiet.
Right. So he has to find a more insidious, almost sneaky way to deliver his critique. What are we actually looking at?
He achieves that through his highly deliberate choice of subject. The visual reference for the central figures in this painting is pulled directly from Charlie Chaplin's 1921 classic silent film, The Kid.
Okay, so this is the visual equivalent of the pop song we talked about earlier.
So
this is the Trojan horse of modern art. Like, think about your own habits for a second.
Right. The listener's habits.
Yeah. We have all built up massive psychological defenses against images of real contemporary misery.
We have to.
If you see a stark photograph of actual displaced people suffering on your social media feed, your immediate reaction is really complex.
You feel a pang of guilt. It makes you highly uncomfortable.
Right. You feel powerless. And so you quickly scroll past it. We just block it out.
We build those walls as a defense mechanism against empathy fatigue.
Empathy fatigue.
In a world completely saturated with 24-hour media, if we internalized every image of suffering, we would be paralyzed. We learn to filter it out just to function.
But Chaplin's silhouette, the iconic bowler hat, the oversized shoes, the little tramp sitting next to the kid, That lowers our guard instantly.
Because it's safe.
Exactly. We see it, and our brain predicts comedy. Mm. We expect slapstick, we expect warmth, nostalgia, something entirely harmless.
And that's why modern artists reclaim these commercial icons for activism. Mm. Because it is a highly effective way to sneak past the viewer's heavily armed emotional gates.
It is a brilliant bait and switch.
It really is. Mm. Once the viewer's guard is down, and they step into the painting expecting that warm nostalgia, the artist springs the trap. He executes this using what his notes describe as an aesthetic of abandonment.
Which, it hits you immediately through the color palette. There is absolutely nothing warm or comedic about the colors in this painting.
No, not at all. We are so conditioned by modern media to expect high contrast, vibrant neon colors designed to grab and hold our attention.
Right. The dopamine hit of bright colors.
Exactly. But in El Chico, all the anticipated comedy and lightness are suffocated by the palette. There are no bright colors to offer relief.
So what are the colors?
The composition is entirely built from dusty ochres, dull moss greens, and the faded, peeling tones of neglected architecture. It creates a closed, heavily claustrophobic space.
So you walk in expecting a joke, and suddenly you realize you are locked in a room made of dirt and peeling paint.
Yes.
And once you are trapped in that suffocating aesthetic, you are forced to look directly at the subjects.
Yeah.
But they are not giving you the performance you want.
Not at all. The composition is highly frontal.
Okay.
The adult, the chaplain figure, and the child are sitting on a concrete step. But they aren't interacting with each other in a sweet, endearing way.
Right, which is what you'd expect from the kid.
Exactly. Instead, they are staring blankly, directly out of the painting, straight through the viewer.
Okay, if you have ever watched a play, you know that feeling of safety in the dark audience.
Oh, yeah, sitting in the dark watching someone else.
Right. The actors are in their world, you are in yours, you have the total protection of the fourth wall.
It's very comfortable.
But occasionally, a director will use a technique where the actors suddenly stop speaking, walk right up to the very edge of the stage, and just stare at the audience in dead silence.
Oh, it is an incredibly unnerving theatrical choice. It forces self-awareness.
It completely shatters the safety of the room. Everyone starts shifting in their seats, coughing, suddenly hyper-aware of their own presence.
Yeah, that is the exact psychological mechanism this painting employs.
It makes you squirm.
It does. And this raises a critical question about how we consume images of suffering. The artist is forcing a confrontation, but it is a confrontation with apathy.
Apathy, right.
The subjects in the painting aren't crying, they aren't screaming for help, and they aren't looking up at the sky in dramatic despair.
Because that would be performing for the viewer.
Exactly. The artist's notes refer to this specific posture as dignity in stillness.
Dignity and stillness, that lack of drama is actually what makes the viewing experience so intensely uncomfortable.
It is. By showing us faces that are completely drained by the sheer monotony of daily survival, the artist denies the viewer the emotional reward of pity.
Wow. The emotional reward of pity, that is a heavy concept.
It really is.
Let's sit with that for a second. Why do we crave that reward as viewers?
Because pity is a transaction with a very neat resolution.
Oh, a transaction.
Yeah. When we see a photograph of someone crying or in acute distress, we can feel a deep sense of sorrow for them, process that emotion, perhaps donate a little money or share a link.
Right. And walk away feeling like we have done our part. We get a clean emotional catharsis.
Exactly. But poverty in these informal settlements, in reality, isn't always loud, dramatic, or tearful.
It's not a movie.
No. Often, it is a slow, heavy, profoundly boring waiting game.
Mm-hmm.
Waiting for a bus that might not come, waiting for systemic help, waiting for something to change.
So they are too exhausted by the structural inequality of their life to feign an expression just to give us that catharsis.
Right. The viewer is forced to hold the gaze of someone who refuses to perform their trauma for an audience.
And that profound, heavy exhaustion connects directly to the overarching theme of the entire exhibition, doesn't it? The one titled Trastio.
It does, yes.
So in colloquial Colombian Spanish, a trastio simply means moving to a new house. Packing your boxes, loading a truck, changing addresses.
Standard moving day stuff.
Right. But in the context of this painting and this heavy, apathetic exhaustion we just talked about, it takes on a much darker structural meaning.
It completely ceases to be about upward mobility. You know, and becomes entirely about the mechanics of forced migration.
Because there is one highly specific detail in the painting that anchors this reality.
The sack.
Yes. The child figure is holding a small, inert blue sack. Just a little nondescript bundle.
Right.
Let's look at the mechanics of a normal move. Usually, a trestio implies you are moving your furniture into a bigger apartment to start a better chapter of your life.
I'll step up.
But this blue sack, this is about what you carry when, materially, you have absolutely nothing left to pack.
Exactly. The trestio concept is reflecting the severe, ongoing trauma of forced migration in modern Latin America.
It's heartbreaking.
It really is. And this is where the Chaplin reference comes full circle in a devastating way.
Oh, how so?
In the 1921 film The Kid, Chaplin's characters are constantly on the run. They're bouncing from shelter to shelter just to evade the authorities and child services.
Right. They exist in a state of perpetual transit. They are just trying not to get caught in a punitive system that wants to break them apart.
And over a century later, modern displaced communities in Latin America are locked in that exact same state of perpetual transit.
Just constantly moving?
They're constantly moving, but it is entirely due to expulsion. They're pushed out by violent conflict, deep economic collapse, or aggressive urban gentrification.
So they are moving out of pure survival, not progress.
Yes, exactly.
So how does that intergenerational trauma physically manifest in the painting?
Through that little blue sack the kid is holding. It represents the invisible weight of that transit.
It's the heavy psychological toll that these communities are forced to carry in their psyches and in their bodies.
When you are constantly uprooted, that instability is passed down from parent to child, you know, moving from one temporary step to the next.
Never allowed to establish roots.
Right. It is the physical manifestation of structural abandonment. When the material structures of society fail you, when housing, safety, and economic opportunity are stripped away, all you have left to carry in your hands is the weight of that failure.
Man. So we have covered a massive amount of ground today.
We really have.
We started at the microscopic weight of 640-gram watercolor paper, moved through the chemistry of mineral granulation, explored the psychology of geographic distance,
and ended on the macroscopic trauma of forced migration.
Yeah. I think this deep dive really proves that art isn't just about rendering pretty pictures or decorating a wall with colors that match your sofa.
Definitely not this art.
It is an active, demanding mechanism. It forces us to examine our own blind spots.
It really holds up a mirror.
And the sheer genius of Jairo Duques El Chico is that it uses the very pop culture symbols we normally use to escape reality, like the harmless, funny image of a silent movie star, to essentially lock us in a room and force us to look structural inequality dead in the eye.
It's powerful. And it leaves us with a deeply provocative timeline to mull over.
What do you mean?
Well, think about it. Charlie Chaplin created this specific critique of poverty and the brutal struggle for survival in 1921.
Right.
Now, here we are in 2025, over a century later. If that exact same comedic image of a marginalized adult and an orphaned child maps flawlessly onto the tragedy of displacement in modern Latin American streets today.
Wow.
What is the true magnitude of human progress?
That is a chilling realization. We think we have come so far technologically and socially.
Right. We tell ourselves a story of constant progress. But if the caricature of precariousness from the 1920s is still an accurate everyday reality for millions right now, we must critically question the media we consume.
What harsh realities is our daily diet of light, nostalgic entertainment trying to anesthetize us against?
Exactly. What massive structural failures are we allowing to hide in plain sight just because they are wrapped in a recognizable, comforting package?
It is the pop song slowed down to a minor key.
It really is.
Once you hear it, it changes how you see everything. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive.
It's been a great conversation.
Go take a closer look at the art, the entertainment, and the symbols around you today. You might be surprised by what they are really trying to tell you. We will catch you next time.